Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustina. With us this week, my colleague, David Lombardo, host of the Capital Press Room. David is also the host of WCNY's Dispatches from Planet Albany podcast and the public affairs television program Connect New York. You can find out more at capitalpressroom.org. Welcome back, David Lombardo.
Thanks for having me, Dave.
Well, as you and I know, as people who cover this, there's no shortage of stories ever in the state capitol. There's really no such thing as a slow news day. And I see you all the time interviewing different folks that we might not think of as being involved in and around state politics. I did, however, want to start with a sort of big piece on the table here. Obviously, the federal government and the cuts is impacting every state in the union. Of course, New York. You recently spoke to Phil Church. He's the president of the New York State Association of Counties. And that's just one area that is going to be impacted by the federal changes. Talk a little bit about him, the interview, and what we can expect.
Sure. We had the Oswego County Administrator, Phil Church, who now serves, as you mentioned, as president of the New York State Association of Counties on the show to talk about how counties are going to have increased obligations as a result of the what's called One Big Beautiful Bill down in D.C. As it pertains to the administration of SNAP benefits as well as Medicaid. And in light of the additional responsibilities they're going to have and some cuts to their funding, they're looking to the state to backfill that support. And they're just one of many stakeholders who are going to be clamoring for funding in 2026 as the result of federal changes. And it remains to be seen who is going to be able to get an additional piece of the pie from the state, because everybody's going to want something and the state has its own problems. So it remains to be seen which stakeholders are going to have significant sway and whether any of this has political repercussions for the congressional Republicans and President Donald Trump, who moved this bill back in July.
Yeah, I mean, David, the cuts don't discriminate between a blue district or a red district.
Yeah, they do, though, disproportionately hit blue states based on some of the policies that they have embraced. So New York, you often hear about the people who are going to have their government-provided health care services or even their government-subsidized health care services impacted. In large part, the number of people that's infected in New York is a product of New York policies and policies that, say, red states maybe haven't actually taken. So some of this is targeted to a certain degree, but things like SNAP benefits, that's something that is, as you said, impacting people, whether you live in a red district, a blue district, or a purple district.
David Lombardo. And then there's the arguments that are being made from the state Republicans. You know, I'll pick one, Republican Minority Leader Will Barclay, who I talked to. You know, they are parroting the congressional line, which is basically when I ask them about cuts to SNAP and Medicaid and things, it's, well, on SNAP, you know, we're dealing with fraud. This has nothing to do with kicking legitimate people off. We're only kicking off the people that don't deserve it. Is that fair?
Well, fair. It's probably a good talking point, but I would say maybe it's a little disingenuous. If you look at some of the, say, work requirements on Medicaid,
right,
and some of the new requirements on SNAP as well, they sound great in practice, but in reality, they are largely just a additional layer of paperwork that can be too much of a burden for people. And so we hear from these nonprofits who are trying to ramp up their efforts to help people navigate this process. And Republicans are all for, you know, feeding people and all for certain programs. And then when they're, you know, on the outside looking in, they find reasons why, you know, we're spending too much. But when they're put in a decision-making position, they're not making cuts. I mean, we saw in New York for decades, Republicans ran the state Senate. They held the executive mansion, and there were not cuts to these programs. There were not demonstrable changes to the administration of these programs. So I think what we sometimes hear from people who are out of power, like Assembly Minority Leader Barclay, are the kind of rhetoric that sounds great, but in practice is not how policymakers in the majority choose to govern.
Well, there's that other statement that you made. Maybe we could go into just a little bit more, because I think people are ready to disqualify it immediately. Well, what do you mean there's too much paperwork? Well, first of all, when it comes to the Republican side, they're often talking about the burden of too much paperwork for small businesses. So now let's look at the human beings at the bottom of the economic scale. Why would it be so difficult?
So maybe to you and me, it doesn't necessarily seem like it's a problem. But I don't know about you. I don't actually have to fill out any paperwork in my day-to-day life. And when I do, I complain about it, whether it's, you know, getting my health insurance forms re-upped at the end of the year or just having to go to the doctor's office.
And you have command of the language.
I do. I have command of the language. I have a college degree from a fine SUNY institution. And that's not a problem for me. But for other people, whether it is an issue with language, whether it is an issue with maybe I only worked 19 hours this week, but I'm going to work 25 the next week, or I'm a seasonal employee, or I'm a cash employee. There are all sorts of challenges that people have to navigate. And I'm not saying that there is not fraud. I'm not saying there isn't abuse. I'm not saying there isn't waste. But what we hear from nonprofits and we hear from people who live and breathe this is that the fraction of people that you might catch and get off programs does not make up for the vast majority of the people who should be receiving these programs, who, you know, these are designed to help. And ultimately, if you're kicking them off, you're going to have more deleterious effects down the road than, you know, any sort of short-term savings.
Yeah, I appreciate that explanation, because we often get pushback when we bring that up, but it is significant. The other part that I'd like to bring up now when it comes to money in New York is the fact that Governor Hochul has spent a great deal of time on an affordability agenda. And one of the things is she's giving these checks back to New Yorkers, $400. And, you know, while right now, if you talk to the state comptroller, now's budgeting isn't the problem. It's out year budgets that are going to be in the billions in the hole. And it makes you kind of turn around and say, is this the kind of thing we should be doing with state funding in light of what's coming?
Well, you know how they say people can't really agree on anything in politics anymore?
Sure.
This is one of those great issues that has united, say, economists on the left side of the aisle and the right side of the aisle. And they're united in the fact that they don't like this policy.
That's right.
And this was originally conceived as a $3 billion proposal from the governor. It was eventually tapered down to $2 billion. It's worth $200 for New Yorkers who made $75,000 or less, and for $400 for families that made $150,000 or less. And there's, you know, a sliding scale for other amounts if you go above that. But what we recently had, you know, our public media colleague Jimmy Vielkind was highlighting was the fact that you might get a check for $200 if you're an individual. Well, maybe put aside $20 to $30 of that, because you're going to have to pay taxes.
Yeah, federal taxes.
On it, which means that a $2 billion program is going to include at least $200 million heading down south to Washington, D.C., which is another knock against this program. And this idea that, you know, I qualify for this check and I am going to cash the check. I'm going to spend the check. Thank you very much for the check. I don't need the check.
We don't need the check.
And there are a lot of people.
And she didn't need to get it so that it was taxed on the federal level. Am I right about that?
So if she wanted to distribute a check like this, it probably had to have a tax. If the governor wanted to just put money in people's pockets, they could have done other things. They could have done a tax credit. It just wouldn't have happened as fast. And it's also, I mentioned disingenuous with Assemblymember Barclay. Let's use the same thing for the governor here.
Sure.
Because, she talks about it as an inflation refund check. Well, inflation levels right now are not as bad as they were in 2022, in 2023, in 2024, when she was also the governor and didn't push this type of initiative. So the idea that it's you know, something that we need right now in this moment and that's a product of inflation is disingenuous, let alone the, you know, backflip bending over she needs to do to talk about where this money comes from, because that's a whole nother issue that is going to bore people to death. But, you know, don't listen too much about what the governor has to say about that.
Well, and, you know, the idea that here we sit with these checks about to go out, mm-hmm. and what are you going to think? Campaign, you know, goodwill of voters, you know, what's the ploy here?
Yeah, I mean, there's this really cynical narrative that people are going to receive this and be like, wow, thanks, Kathy Hochul for right. Thinking about me. And I'll have a warm spot in my heart when I head to the ballot maybe in June for the primary or November in the general election. I don't think most people are even going to look at the line to see who this check is from. They'll say, great, I got this. Maybe it's from the federal government. They might not even put two and two together. And again, there are people for whom this check is going to be important. This is going to be something that is meaningful for them week to week. And then there are a lot of people for whom this is going to be a small portion of their national grid bill. And so they're not going to think twice about it. And they'll have bigger issues with why did their national grid bill cost so much? And maybe that's Governor Kathy Hochul's fault.
Well, let's go there. I mean, it's just after, you see the Public Service Commission in New York, mm-hmm. and it was like an overnight, here comes the rate increase. We're voting as if there was no argument or discussion about it ever. And this is National Grid and Hudson Gas and Electric. And there's been all sorts of problems, but there's a monopoly here. And now
it is a monopoly.
Yeah, I mean,
they have a regulated monopoly
where they literally can raise the price yearly and they seem to get away with it.
Yeah. So there's a lot of different factors here. And I will say to the Public Services Commission's credit, this process is, while it's opaque, there are a lot of different stakeholders that are going to bat for these different issues. There are people who are going to bat for, say, you and I as ratepayers. The Public Utility Law Project of New York, while they're undermanned and outgunned, do a great job in terms of speaking up for people. But there's a lot at play for the Public Service Commission here. And it's not so much on the supply side of things, but it's sort of the delivery side of the equation, where they have to figure out, well, what kind of infrastructure do we need? What does the grid need to look like? And these things all do cost a lot of money. And the one area where they definitely come under fire and where they're probably less able to play defense has to do with the profits for utilities like National Grid. So they're kind of being given a little more wiggle room to make money, more so than in other states. So I think my Times Union colleague Ezra Bitterman has been focusing on this, and there's this case to be made that, okay, 6.5% return to the shareholders. That makes sense. Well, maybe National Grid's being allowed 9.5%. Well, what's the deal with that 3 percentage points? Maybe that makes a big headline. Doesn't necessarily make a big difference in what you're actually paying as a ratepayer. So this is one of those other issues. I'm going to come and say the D word again, disingenuous. And we have these politicians who are like, well, let's take the power back from the Public Service Commission. Let's put a veto check on what they do. Well, the Public Service Commission in many ways is making the hard choices that these politicians don't want to make and have actually put them in a place to make because of mandates that the utilities have to deal with and, this green transition, which they're also having to put money aside for. So maybe I'm coming in a little too hot and cynical here.
I don't think so.
I appreciate that.
No, because the environment, look what's happening when it comes to the environmental legislation and mm-hmm. things. And then you have an editorial in the New York Times today as we speak saying that the Trump administration's policies are only going to raise the cost of energy for Americans. So talk about hard choices. Now the governor's embracing nuclear power.
Yeah, she's endorsing nuclear, which, if it ever is materialized, which I think is still a big if, regardless of how many people are leaning their shoulders into it, this is something that's 5-10 years down the road. And some of the more immediate things are the conversation around a natural gas pipeline proposal.
Which just got approved.
Yeah, well, it was given a green light by the Public Service Commission, which basically said, yes, we could see a case for needing this for reliability purposes, but they still have additional hurdles to go through.
Sure.
For example, the State Department of Environmental Conservation has to grant a water quality permit, basically saying this isn't going to have an adverse impact on the water. Well, multiple times in the past, they have said it does. And we've had the new DEC commissioner, Amanda Lefton, on the show. And I basically said, have any laws changed regarding this? No. Have any understanding of the environment changed? No. Well, then why wouldn't you reject this pipeline proposal since it's the exact same thing as was advanced in the past? And she sort of hems and haws, talks about case law. But in reality, they can do whatever they want.
That's what I was going to say. What does it matter, right? If the political will is there and they push it, they're going to get it.
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, they open themselves up to lawsuits, which I think is why she was kind of choosing her words carefully. And I think if this proposal, which moves gas around the Tri-City area, is approved, I think environmental groups will take the state to court over the water quality permitting process. But that is one of those areas where a pipeline is going to cost money. Ultimately, there's a case to be made maybe that it ends up being cheaper form of delivery and that there will be savings down the road. But there are upfront costs with that that are going to be ultimately shouldered by ratepayers.
We're speaking with David Lombardo, host of the Capital Press Room. You can read more and listen at capitalpressroom.org. David, this week, the Advocates for Medical Aid in Dying legislation held a gathering. They're trying to push Governor Hochul to sign this legislation. She's been very quiet on this, sort of holding it close to the vest. But I'm interested in this because it's been a 10-year fight, a decade-long push, maybe even a little longer, to get this legislation to be signed. They finally get it all the way through. I know Corinne Carey, who I've talked to, who runs the coalition trying to pass this into law, and she seemed very positive for a long time that the governor was definitely going to sign it. Now some urgency as they're trying to push her to do so.
Yeah, I definitely don't have a crystal ball on this issue to make a prediction on what the governor is going to do. I mean, for context, we have to think about this governor is someone who is very liberal and progressive on issues like reproductive health, something that flies in the face of the Catholic Church, which she talks about meaning a lot to her, but at the same time has not necessarily embraced this issue, which is another one that the Catholic Church cares about. In terms of the polling, though, which, again, I hopefully don't sound too cynical, this is something that does poll well, but it's not overwhelmingly well. When I look at this and when I think about this, I think about it as something that means a lot to the proponents and maybe doesn't necessarily mean as much to the opponents. And I think the opponents are people who already maybe have an issue with the governor on things like abortion. So if the governor's making a calculation that maybe I'm going to alienate more people by signing this, I think that might be an overblown estimation because she has not played her hand at this point. She's not revealed really how she's thinking about this, except to say whatever she does, it's going to be the right decision, which was an odd way to frame things from my ears. I don't really know what's going to happen. All I can say is I think it'll be one of those bills that if it gets vetoed, it's going to be on Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve, Thanksgiving Eve. And if it gets signed, I really wonder whether the governor will lean into the bill and the optics and try to rally support or whether she will, just sign this with little fanfare. If I were her and I do decide to put my shoulder into this issue, I think I would try to lean into it. I would try to surround myself with the advocates who have a very emotional and sometimes persuasive story to tell. And I think if that she can push that human element more, I think it will impact a lot of people who maybe are on the fence about this issue or maybe who have reservations but don't care that much.
It also would be the governor's chance to clear any misinformation. For example, the folks in the coalition who worked on the bill put a lot of back checks in place so that it wasn't, so you couldn't just put your mother to sleep, for example. Doctors have to sign off. There are a number of checks and balances in this process, which the other side was very worried about in the beginning. And they continue to say that. So there is some misinformation out there as well. I'm not advocating for either side, but I agree with you that if she does decide to sign it, she needs to lean into the legislation.
Yeah, I mean, something like this, where we're kind of going into new territory, there can be problems with something like this. There are very few bills that are adopted in Albany and are implemented smoothly with no unintended consequence. So
absolutely,
something like this could have unintended consequences. You try to think about all the different ramifications. You try to think about, as I said, unintended consequences. But in reality, life doesn't necessarily match up with legislation. So it's always possible that there could be some horror stories, that there could be anecdotal accounts of this not going well if it is implemented. Whether that is the vast majority of cases, remains to be seen and something we may or may not have to deal with.
We'll find out soon enough. He is David Lombardo, host of the Capitol Press Room. I'm David Gustin. You're joining us on the Capitol Connection this week. All right. Well, let's move on to something that I'm interested in and want to bring in the next governor's race into, which is there was a recent gathering of the folks who sponsor the Living Wage, New York's Living Wage Coalition, basically. It comes off of One Fair Wage, which is the national group. They specifically in New York are going after tipped wages, but they are also calling for a higher minimum wage and a living wage for all. What struck me was, first of all, New York Governor Kathy Hochul has endorsed Zohran Mamdani in the New York City mayoral race, very progressive, supports a living wage. At the event that they held, which I know the governor was invited to, she did not come. That could be a scheduling conflict, could be anything. But who was there? Her Democratic Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, who's certainly left of Hochul and a supporter of Mamdani, and running against her. So it's just interesting to me, the juxtaposition. She endorses the progressive, the Democratic Socialist.
She endorsed the candidate from her party. I mean, is how I think about it.
Yeah, but...
Sure. I mean, that's what she did. She didn't endorse a centrist. She didn't endorse an independent. She didn't endorse a Republican. She's a Democrat, and she endorsed the person who won the Democratic primary.
What about the issue?
Well, so the issue is one where I think there is a lot of disagreement. And I think that something like the minimum wage in general, which I think starts as the foundation for this conversation, is one that divides upstate and downstate Democrats, in large part because the cost of living is so demonstrably different in New York City than upstate New York. And while we have regional differences in the minimum wage, they don't necessarily account for how different the costs are. And there's a lot at play with that lead up you just mentioned. So I'm going to start with the tipped wages and just say this is something, this idea of getting rid of a sub minimum wage that is reliant on tips is something that's been talked about for years in Albany and doesn't really get a lot of momentum, in large part because there is division among the restaurant community on this. There are some servers who say, I do a lot better based on the status quo, and I'm worried about this. So I don't think the tip wage issue is going to move in the near future. The other issue you bring up, this idea of a living wage, and often people talk about a minimum wage increase as about finding a living wage. Well, I think that's, to use the D word again, disingenuous, because if I'm making $16 an hour, if I'm making $17 an hour, if you raise the Capital Region minimum wage to $20 an hour, it's still not going to be enough to live this lifestyle that you want to live.
They say 32.
Well, right. And so that's where we're at now. And that is a non-starter in Albany. Maybe they could get some sort of regional minimum wage adopted in New York City. But my guess is that that's something that would need support from the legislature, that they would need some sort of buy-in at the Capitol. And I don't think you're going to find that given the makeup of the Democratic majority here in Albany. And while there are progressives who back this, I think it ends up being more of a talking point. I think it's more of a rallying cry. I don't know how serious some of these people are who back this. It's one of those progressive issues where I think they know they can support it, because it's not going anywhere. I think someone like Assembly Member Zohran Mamdani, you know, that socialist who is running under the Democratic banner for mayor, I think he definitely believes in it. But I think there are some other people who pick it up and run with it and maybe aren't as serious about it. And I don't know whether that's the case with Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado. But as he tries to wrest the Democratic gubernatorial nomination away from Kathy Hochul, he needs to figure out any sort of wedge issue. He's trying to figure out anything that might, you know, catch fire in a Democratic primary for governor. And right now, he hasn't found that, the way Zohran Mamdani was able to focus on the rent and free buses. There hasn't that same sort of issue at the statewide level. So I think what we're seeing from him is basically throwing everything and anything against the wall to try to find out what resonates with Democratic primary voters. Where can I make a difference and try to, you know, peel away what is a big lead for her right now?
Well, and also, since we're mentioning the New York City mayor race, we've got a former governor in there, Andrew Cuomo. Now you've got the mayor of New York City who has dropped out, Eric Adams. Sliwa seems to think it might be an advantage to him. He's the Republican candidate. He hasn't dropped out yet. Of course, when you look at the polling, the recent polling, it says that Cuomo gains 10 points once they drop out. So perhaps a better chance, but it still seems like momentum's in favor of Mamdani.
Yeah, if you had asked me this question about this race, and I should put the caveat that, you know, we're talking 3 hours north.
Absolutely. And there's time between now and Election Day.
There is, although we're down to less than a month now, and early voting is going to start in a few days. If you had asked me about this race in the aftermath of the Buffalo mayoral election in 2021, when the incumbent Byron Brown lost the Democratic primary to India Walton, a socialist, and then ultimately beat her badly in just what was a write-in campaign. He wasn't even on
the
ballot. I would have said we're going to see something similar with Andrew Cuomo, who is actually on the ballot. But there are a lot of differences here. For one, that was a really low turnout primary in Buffalo. This was a high turnout primary in New York City. And I think there seems to be wider support for Zohran Mamdani amongst the electorate than there was for India Walton. And I also think Andrew Cuomo is a much more polarizing figure.
It's a little Cuomo fatigue, you think, too?
I think it is, but I also think Republicans don't necessarily want to be strategic about their vote in New York City. And while they represent a very small fraction of the voters there, I mean, it's less than the Democrats and the blanks, the unaffiliated voters, I think Cuomo would need a much larger portion of those voters to be a serious candidate. And I think they have a real issue with him based on his time as governor. And so, you know, if we were seeing some polling that showed Cuomo in a better position, I would say, sure, you know, that makes sense. He's the centrist. He's the moderate. It doesn't matter that he's not one of the major party candidates running here. But right now, I think conventional wisdom, the status quo needs to be that Zohran Mamdani is going to be the next mayor of New York City.
You know what, David Lombardo? I get talking to you. The time disappears.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
It's a great thing. Okay. I have about six more things to ask you. You've been doing great work.
I'll try to talk less.
No. You just agree to come back.
Okay.
All right. David Lombardo, host of the Capital Press Room for WCNY. Head to capitalpressroom.org and check out all the other things that he's doing. He is a jewel here down at the Capitol, and we appreciate his work tremendously. David, we'll talk again soon, I hope.
Thanks, David.
Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.